This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Coming up, we'll continue our ongoing series with Susan Campbell. She's been following the story of a man named Sal, who, after 20 years of being homeless in the greater Hartford area, finally has a place to call home. We'll get a bit of the history of homelessness in our state and later check in on a national effort to end chronic homelessness. But first, according to a 2014 report, more than 300,000 Connecticut households struggle to pay their energy bills. In fact, the average low-income household owes about $2,500 more in annual energy bills than it can actually afford. Today, we'll take a closer look at what is driving the state's energy affordability gap and what's being done to help those affected by it. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Senator Bob Duff, who's Connecticut Senate Majority Leader, and he's joining us to talk about this issue, something he's been involved with for quite some time. And Senator Duff, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Pat Rice is here. She's Executive Director of Operation Fuel. And Pat, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here as well. I guess I'll start with you, Senator, and then I'd like to get Pat's take on this. When we talk about the energy affordability gap, what exactly are we talking about here?
We're really talking about the fact that obviously people need to heat their homes, whether it's electric, gas, or oil, and of what they really can afford to pay based on their income. And obviously, as we see more income inequality or an income gap, we have families who are struggling more and more each and every year to pay for that. I mean, this year we had a little bit more relief from the sense of oil prices came down, but over the last few years, prices really went up, and it made it very, very difficult for families to survive. In addition, not only a family, but senior citizens as well who are on fixed incomes, who cannot continue to afford to pay, and they keep turning their heat down, which is very dangerous for them. And I would say lastly is that it affects not only seniors and families, but children and others at the same time, where some of the federal dollars that usually come and help for relief for assistance has been cut or at least been flat funded in a time where prices have gone up.
This is important, Pat, because home energy needs, the ability to cool or heat your house, this is something that everyone has to do. It honestly doesn't really matter how much money you make. You still have to have heat in the wintertime. You need to make sure you can stay cool in the summertime. And those prices, to a certain extent, cost the same for people all across the state. Talk about why this gap has gotten so big.
Well, I think the gap has gotten big because the cost of energy, even though we've had a relief this year, both in oil and also in natural gas, the winter was cold. And so it's been volatile, and it continues to rise. We've been releasing this report for the past 6 years, and every single year, even when we had a more robust federal program, the gap continued to rise. I think it's the high cost of energy and incomes just not keeping up.
Well, and that's the thing. You said that we've had some energy relief, you know, whether or not it's oil prices being down a little bit. We've just seen another rate cut that's coming from the electric companies. How much of this really has to do with people's ability to earn, Pat? I mean, at the end of the day, energy prices are volatile. Those will go up and down for everyone. But it seems as though the gap is really there because people just aren't able to earn the money to pay for their basic needs.
Yes. I mean, I can't remember when Social Security has had a cost of living increase. So people are living on dollars that were dollars more than 10 years ago, and they're seeing prices jump. It's not only just in their direct costs for energy, but it's also in other costs. I mean, all that those costs are passed on to the consumer. And so, you know, we're seeing, and this is very alarming, we're seeing an increase of requests from people who are seniors. Last year, we saw over a 20% increase of people asking for help that are over 65, and that's pretty concerning to us.
Senator Duff, what help is out there now? So we're talking about a population that, if we've got these numbers at the top of the program, right, some 300,000 Connecticut households essentially are paying more for energy than they can actually afford to pay. So I guess the first question I have for you is, well, okay, what's out there to help them right now?
Right. Well, we do have – there's a federal program that the state receives money every year, but over many years, we've been struggling to ensure that we are either flat funded or not cut. because, as Pat said very eloquently, you know, we've had need that has increased. We have people who need more help. We have many families in Connecticut. The average low-income household owes about $2,560 more in annual energy bills than they can afford to pay. So you have that, but that doesn't nearly do enough. So that's really where Operation Fuel comes in and why it's really become near and dear to my heart, because it allows people to make donations to help the families and help others who really need the help. You think about it, Operation Fuel is able to generally help with a fill-up of an oil tank. And with a cold winter like we've had this past year, that'll help only so much. And so that's when you have people making very difficult decisions about how they will keep their homes heated and what temperature they'll keep it. If you have seniors and others who have, muscular diseases, things like that, that keep their homes in the 50s over the summertime, over the wintertime, and that is extremely cold for them and not healthy. For kids, how do you have kids be able to focus on their homework and their schoolwork and make that a priority if they're sitting in a cold home? So, you know, I have that, plus the fact that I would say that, especially in our cities, our urban areas, where people may live in older homes that may not have all the insulation or other types of conservation methods that are typical maybe for a newer home or maybe for some suburban homes, it makes it even harder for people who want to make sure they're conserving everything else, but they can if they're renting a place and it's nothing but old windows and uninsulated homes and things like that. So what we're trying to do is get the word out about Operation Fuel, what a great program it is, and really still talk about the gap that exists out there for families and try and cover that gap so that people can stay warm in the wintertime.
There have been a lot of moves made both at the federal and the state level over the course of the last couple of years in attempts to make it easier to pay for home energy audits and energy efficiency. A lot of the buildings that you're talking about that frankly aren't as efficient as they could be. I mean, is that another point of investment, Senator, where maybe if we're making it so that we don't have to use as much energy, as much electricity, as much oil or gas, maybe that will help solve some of the problem.
Right. We've been doing that quite a bit, and Connecticut is a leader in this area. And over the last 2 years when I was the chair of the Energy Committee, these are the things that we tackled. And I was a member of the Appropriations Committee as well, and that's where we were able to help fund Operation Fuel as well in creative ways so that they would ensure that they'd have that funding for folks. But I agree with you. We are looking at this year ways in which if you are a tenant and you receive some sort of assistance, that we help incent the owner of that property to try and get make sure that they're using all the conservation methods out there, all the clean energy methods out there, because – you know, the cheapest energy is the energy we don't use. I'm sure you've heard that from Dan Esty at times and others. And I agree with that. So if we can get, especially in the urban areas, we can get homes that are much more energy efficient. We can get owners to take on those kinds of things. Really, it's no cost to them. And it helps, I think, rent out their homes and provides better value for them. So that's what we want to do.
And I'm wondering if you can pick up on that, Pat. In large part, we're talking about a population that is part of this energy gap that we're talking about that probably also is residing in many cases in rental properties or in older homes. They haven't been able to upgrade a lot of these things. Much of the state, it feels, has been able to take advantage of some of these programs to use less electricity, but many other folks have not, and they suffer because of it.
They do, and it's not as easy for them to take part, because if they have a landlord who doesn't agree to that, the landlord can give them a real hard time. But one thing we are doing at Operation Fuel is everyone who comes in for an application for energy assistance, we're helping them to fill out, at least at the minimum, the energy audit, which is no cost to them. They get about $900 worth of services through that energy audit. And so we're doing that and that's some savings. The deeper measures, that's going to take a lot more than we can do at Operation Fuel, but we're also going to be working with others to make sure they're part of the Energize Connecticut, because Operation Fuel gets the services out through 108 fuel banks located throughout the state. And so if we can get our fuel banks on board to be more proactive in the Energize Connecticut movement, I think we can go a long way to bridging that gap.
We're going to be talking about some of the things the state can do to help close this energy affordability gap. hundreds of thousands of Connecticut residents unable to pay their fuel bills. We're talking with Pat Rice from Operation Fuel, Senator Bob Duff, the Connecticut Senate Majority Leader, and we want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Ben is calling from Wallingford. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yep. I just wanted to say that we could eliminate the need for fuel assistance if we were to go to a 100% renewable energy model where we're not using gas or oil, that where the price fluctuates. Because once you put up the renewable energy model, there's no cost for fuel on a daily basis. It's only, you know, using wind or sun that's coming to us anyways. And that's why a lot of people are gathering on May 31st in Hartford for the climate march to push for 100% renewable energy. So I just wondered about the senator and the Operation Fuel, if they're pushing for the expansions of renewable energy and allowing everyone to participate in the shared solar bill as opposed to just being a pilot program.
Thank you, Ben, very much. Senator Duff?
Thank you, and thank you, Ben, for your comment. Again, I've been on the Energy Technology Committee my entire time in the legislature up until this year when I became majority leader, and I will say that over the last 2 years when I was chair, we were extremely aggressive about clean energy and working in clean energy. As a matter of fact, we're the Connecticut has the seventh fastest growing jobs in the clean energy sector, and we do a lot on conservation as well. So, and as I said, the cheapest energy is energy we don't use. I will say this, that on the shared solar bill, that was a bill last year that I had spent a lot of time on, And I thought we had an agreement. As a matter of fact, I gave the utilities, which I don't give a lot of credit all the time, for really bending over backwards on the issue, because there are shifted costs. There's unanticipated consequences on a shared solar concept. But I was extremely in favor of it. There were folks who at that time, I think, wanted a little bit too much on the solar side, and we had to pull the bill. This year, I assume it'll continue to stay a pilot because there are shifted costs. People have to recognize that, and they have to recognize the fact, and we have to look at that as a state so that we're not moving costs from one bucket to another bucket in order to make sure that we're feeling good. I want to make sure we do shared solar as we're doing other clean energy methods in a way that makes sense, that's practical, and that keeps the cost down.
Just as a point of resonance with the next conversation we're going to have as we talk about chronic homelessness in the state, there's long been an effort amongst those who advocate for the homeless to work on two tracks, right? One is we need to shelter those who are in danger right now, who are in need of a roof over their heads. But at the same point, everyone realizes that just building more shelters doesn't help solve the problem. And I think Ben gets at one of those points where we want to be working on two tracks. We want to make sure that we're able to help pay for energy for people who can't afford it right now. But the long-term goal has to be, how do we get our overall energy costs down? So you've talked about some of the things that the state has done. I want to talk about your bill regarding this in a moment. One thing I will ask is, do you feel like the state's move toward more natural gas infrastructure has helped or hurt our ability to get a low fuel cost to the people that Pat is working with?
Thanks. I think it's helping. And again, I give Governor Malloy and former Commissioner Esty and Commissioner Klee a lot of credit on this as well. We've all worked very well in a bipartisan way and also with the legislature and the executive branch. Connecticut had some of the lowest amount of natural gas penetration in the area. And I think it was important to give people the choices of whether they want oil or natural gas or something else. Of course, we want to have people use as much clean energy and conservation because I believe in that personally, and I think that we should continue to move in that direction. But giving people choices, especially if natural gas is cheaper, the cheaper option, if they can sign up for that, that's great. I think when you are talking about growing jobs and building businesses in the state, when you have people have that ability to have natural gas and it's cheaper, then they should have that chance to be able to do that and grow those jobs. I've had a number of homeowners who said, you know what, we switched over to natural gas over the last few years. Our oil bill used to be $5,000 a year. Now our natural gas bill is $1,500 a year. I'm not picking on the oil industry, just saying that people need to have those choices out there so that they can decide what is best for them. And for us, anyway, from a state perspective, if natural gas is cheaper and we're able to do more with the budget we have than through natural gas, and that's what we need to do to help more folks on Operation Fuel.
Quickly, Pat, I mean, how does that work in your world? We think of Operation Fuel in part being able to subsidize the cost of home heating oil. How does it change the equation when it comes to more and more, whether it's landlords or individual homeowners, heating with natural gas? Does it at all change the way in which you do your work?
Well, it's, most of our state and most of energy assistance that we provide during the winter is deliverable fuel. And, we do have a lot of remote areas, and it's going to take a while for those options to be available. And in the meantime, we're the shelter component of this two-prong attack on energy. We're an emergency program, and so therefore we deal with the crisis of the moment. But yes, long term, there's got to be a number of options for people.
One thing I'll say is, using that metaphor, though, I think that if the state's homeless population increased at the rate that the affordability gap has increased over the course of the last couple of years, we would be thinking of this as a much more major crisis than it is, Pat, right? I mean, it seems as though the gap that you're talking about, more and more people being unable to afford their fuel bills, has just skyrocketed. And this is an emergency situation for a lot of people, and I don't think we're paying attention to the size of the growth.
Because this problem is not an in-your-face problem. It's people who are really doing some dangerous things, and they're out of sight, out of mind. But you're right. If this were homeless, as many homeless people on the street as our affordability gap, it would be considered a crisis. But right now, it's not considered a crisis because people are doing all that they can to keep it together.
And clearly, it could be a reason why people might be forced out of their homes. They're unable to afford it. Do you have numbers on that? Do you have a sense of how many people may indeed not be able to pay for their bills and then have to end up in shelters?
Well, anecdotally we do, because we hear the stories. If someone loses their electricity or they can't afford to pay for their energy and they live in a rental home, that's grounds for eviction. That's considered, you're providing an unsafe habitat. But we don't keep those numbers, but that's something we're looking for to do in the future, because we really need to start to document this issue.
I want to ask Senator Duff about this bill that he's working on, but I'll ask you first, Pat, to lead into this. What do you need from the state of Connecticut?
Well, what we need from the state of Connecticut is not to have volatile energy prices, because we just can't keep up. I mean, the affordability gap is 305,000 households in the state of Connecticut. Our best year, we helped 10,000 households. We average around 7,000 households. So you can see we're only scratching the surface.
Mm. So, Senator, tell me about this bill, SB 570, an act concerning electric fixed bill fees and grid modernization.
Well, I wish I could give you all the details on it. I'm not on the Energy Committee any longer. So, yeah. But I can tell you that there is components out there in order to be able to deal with whether it's more solar, for solar SREC, I think it's called. The grid modernization, I know others have been pushing from a standpoint of how do we ensure that we're working in a regional way. The part of the issue is we've worked over a number of years when I was chair to look internally, whether we're with our renewable portfolio standard and getting prices down on that, providing additional energy sources such as natural gas and other clean energy and conservation methods. I think now what has been turned to has been looking more a regional way with the Governor Malloy, with the six state agreement in New England. I mean, think about the fact that our six states are probably still smaller than many states out west. And if we're going to really think about this in a real way that's going to help drive down costs, we need to deal with this regionally. We've got to get greater pipeline capacity coming from the west. We've got to modernize those pipelines. We've got to get better electrical infrastructure coming from the north down to the south. And there are a number of proposals out there right now in order to build some of that infrastructure. It takes time. There's a lot of people who are for and against these things. There are people who will tie stuff up in court. Things that may look good for consumers, but on the other hand, may not look good for corporations. And it's a matter of trying to push through all those kinds of things and work in a way that works with other governors and others and other legislatures in the region. We have two new governors this year in our region. So we had to kind of start a little bit from scratch. I know the governor did. Governor Malloy had some folks over at the convention center about 2 weeks ago on this issue. He has good folks over at the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection working on it. But, you know, from my standpoint, my experience on the Energy and Technology Committee, we have done a lot of things internally, but now it really is time for us to work outside our state and work with the region. And I think that's going to be the thing that's going to drive down our costs.
We just have a minute or so. Have the electric utilities, the energy utilities, been a good partner for you in this? We reached out to Eversource to comment today. Of course, we're seeing that Eversource and UI now cutting their rates after quite a bit of talk over the course of the last several months about rates going up. Now rates are going back down again. I assume this will provide some relief. How are the utilities acting as far as you're concerned as a partner to work with on these issues?
Well, I have a good relationship with the utilities. And I think at times that they, obviously they're a public company, and the folks I have with at the Capitol are good folks, and I enjoy working with them. I would say this, that part of the issue over the wintertime with the prices spiking is because of the volatility, because of the lack of infrastructure. It's not necessarily because of a company. And it's hard. This is complicated stuff for folks to understand. All they know is their bills are going up, and I understand that. So this is why it's important for us to continue to do what we do. I just want to say one thing to Ben, as he called about the shared solar. I personally have 100% clean energy coming into my house. I pay a little extra for that, and it's 100% clean energy. I would ask others around the state to do the same thing. It's a little investment into the environment. If you don't have solar, we don't have shared solar yet. Go out and buy 100% clean energy like I do, and I think that will help drive down costs as well, and it'll make a very good statement about us here in Connecticut.
Can you just tell people how to do that? Because it's not exactly self-evident how you would do that.
Right, exactly. Well, right now we have to have about 20% of our energy as clean energy, but you just go on the Energize CT site, and you can shop around as to the rates that you want, but there's a number of different companies right now that will offer certain various amounts of 100% clean energy, whether it's solar, wind, or some other type of energy, and you can shop around for the rates that you want, but I think it is a very good investment.
Pat, I just want to give you the last word on this very quickly. We're talking about this now before summer even hits, and a lot of people think about fuel costs when the winter is just around the corner. Why is this so important to talk about right now?
Because, well, you know, Connecticut is what we call a no-free state, and so a lot of people deferred paying their bills because they were protected during the winter. Now they're vulnerable. They're vulnerable to utility shutoffs, and that since May 1st. And so Operation Fuel stays open to help people who are now in this vulnerable state. We're seeing an ever large increase of demand for people catching up to their winter bills. We're not even talking about air conditioning. We're talking about basic electricity, like keeping their food cool, their medicines. Having a house in the summer with no electricity, it's not even a fan or thing. It's about basic survival. And I hate to sound like an alarmist, but we're seeing such an increase in the summer months. That's why we have, over the past several years, stayed open. It's not as sexy. It doesn't get as much play in the summer, but it is more dangerous for people in the summer now than it is in the winter.
Pat Rice is Executive Director of Operation Fuel. Good to see you, and thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having us here.
And Senator Bob Dove, Connecticut Senate Majority Leader, thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more about homelessness and basic human needs. Susan Campbell will join us to continue her series, including a profile of a man she knows named Sal, who finally has a place to call home. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Over the past few months, writer and journalist Susan Campbell's been bringing us stories about the homeless population in Greater Hartford and the progress of the 100-day challenge to end homelessness. Today, we'll get an update on Sal, a man who, after 20 years on the streets, finally has a place to call home.
The sound you're about to hear is something of a miracle. Listen carefully.
How's that sound?
How's it sound to you?
Sounds good.
Yeah, all right.
My own place.
Yeah.
My apartment. Yeah. Mine.
On April 23rd, after 20 years on the streets, some spent in shelters and some spent on the streets, Salvatore Pinna moved into a Hartford apartment, his first ever.
It just felt good.
Pinna is one of the success stories for Greater Hartford's 100-day challenge to greatly reduce chronic homelessness. Pinna spent the first night on his apartment floor, but the household goods and furniture began arriving the next day.
No more sleeping outside. No more sleeping in the shelters. I got my own bathroom. I got my own bedroom, living room, kitchen.
Sal is one of 60 people who are chronically homeless and have been housed or conditionally matched to housing during the Greater Hartford 100-Day Challenge. The 100-Day team has set a goal to house 100 people by June 19th. It's been a work in progress. When advocates realized that proper identification kept many clients from being housed, they held a document fair on May 9th at Chrysalis Center in Hartford. They worked with roughly 165 people to get birth certificates, driver's licenses, and other proper IDs. Advocates say something as simple as Hartford's discussion of a municipal ID can literally open doors for people who have been homeless. Matt Morgan, executive director at Journey Home, the 100-Day Challenge lead agency.
I think it would be a great step. I feel certain that many landlords would accept a municipal ID, whereas right now, if you don't have a Connecticut ID, then you're out of luck.
Jamie Torres was standing in line at the document fair. He injured his hip delivering medical supplies and for the last year has been living with a friend in East Windsor. To get housing, he needs a birth certificate.
I think back to when I used to deliver the medical equipment, I used to jump off the truck instead of just using the stairs. So if you jump off the truck, 40 times a day and you work five or six times a week, that's 200 times a week.
Torres, like others, is often just one piece of documentation away from housing.
I don't let that hamper me from doing what I have to do. People ask me if I'm in pain all the time. Oh, you're in pain. Are you okay? Can I help you? People are always willing to help me out. But I never complain about it. I just keep it to myself.
The kind of homelessness we know now really only came about in the last 30 or so years. Sister Pat McCain started St. Vincent de Paul in Middletown, and she just retired as the executive director at Hartford's Mercy Housing and Shelter Corporation. She remembers when homelessness started to become so entrenched.
There have always been some people who are homeless, but I'm told that even during the Depression, if a person was able to work and could get a job, they probably had a place to live. That is not true now.
Historians say that along about the late 70s, early 80s, people teetering on the edge saw deep cuts to federal assistance programs. Housing costs were rising, while housing options like single-room occupancy, hotels, or SROs were shrinking. In an effort to improve cities, developers tore down the old flop hotels and replaced them with housing that those former SRO residents could not afford, and state hospitals were shrinking or closing.
We lost units of housing, SROs, apartments, units at state hospitals. We lost all of these.
So what McCain calls a perfect storm tore through housing in Connecticut and left in its wake nothing. No housing options for people who earlier at least had a place to lay their heads.
We didn't invest as a country, or states, I guess. We didn't continue to invest at the same rate we had.
You won't find too many people who will say that places like Mansfield Training School and Hospital or Norwich State Hospital should have stayed open. But as McCain says, those places at least provided some semblance of stable housing. The Norwich facility, which opened in 1904 as the Norwich State Hospital for the Insane, once housed more than 3,000 people.
When they closed down the state hospitals, it took me a long time for this to dawn on me. But when they went into the state hospital, chances are they didn't come out because there were no medications. There was nothing to help a person deal with their mental illness, get better, cope with their daily lives. So most people who went in stayed there. So I realized at some point that was permanent housing. So you close a hospital in Fairfield, in Norwich, and part of Middletown that had thousands of beds. You've now lost thousands of units of housing.
There was no backup plan for those who were displaced. Some were moved to other hospitals, such as Connecticut Valley Hospital in Middletown, but some were simply discharged. The public policy, says McCain, was draconian.
It was pretty much turning people loose.
We have never known precisely how to handle abject poverty. In colonial times, Connecticut had laws on the books that said town inhabitants could warn out so-called transients, whom townsfolk felt were unsuitable for their town. Through the years, homelessness was considered a temporary situation brought on by an act of God, such as a fire or flood, and not a permanent condition. A A 1910 Hartford Current story tells of a census taken among the homeless sleeping in cheap lodging houses on State and Front Streets. Most of Hartford's homeless shelters opened roughly 35 years ago as a reaction to the growing homeless population brought on by conditions described by McCain. There was a sense at the time that homelessness had been ignored and could be no longer. Immaculate Conception Shelter and Housing Corporation, now ImmaCare, was started after Father James M. Doniger, then a priest at the Immaculate Conception Church on Park Street, found a man frozen to death in the neighborhood in 1981.
It was a young kid came and said, "Father, come." So he went down. This poor gentleman was leaning against a stoop in the rear of this building, and he was dead 2 days after Christmas.
The young man was from a prominent Mexican family, Doniger said, but he drank. The next night, the priest could not stand the thought of one other person freezing to death. He vowed he wouldn't let that happen again.
I didn't ask. The next night, I opened up the basement of the church as a shelter. I eventually talked to the archbishop, and he used to give me money for it. And he said, "I just want you to know, if you would ask me permission, I'd have said no. Because of liability." And I said, "I understand that." But he said, "You didn't ask."
Parishioners volunteered to cook meals, make beds, keep the shelter open, but it was all done without permits or permission. When the city health department threatened to close him down, Doniger stood firm.
I said, "Fine, but you're going to have to carry me out."
ImmaCare grew to include an emphasis on housing, including opening Casa de Francisco, a 50-unit supportive housing across the street from the shelter. Doniger supported the shift, as he does the new approach to homelessness embodied in the 100-day challenge, that homelessness is preventable and that Connecticut can see an end to it. Sister Pat McCain agrees.
You know, and in the long run, this saves so much money. If you think about it, having that person who's been homeless for 20 years, my guess is they've been in and out of shelters, they've been in and out of emergency rooms, they've been maybe in and out of the state hospital if this fellow had anger issues, maybe in and out of detox. All that is really expensive. A day in the state hospital will cost more than 2 months' rental full subsidy. Mm. So, you know, where's the efficiency here? And you get that person into housing, then they're going to go on with their lives, and they're not going to need that subsidy as you move forward. I believe we could end homelessness. The question is, do we have the will to do it?
For Sal, an apartment is the first step in a long road to self-sufficiency. Next stop, a job, and the knowledge that sometimes, with the right amount of will and support, really good things can happen.
If it's a dream, don't wake me.
That's Susan Campbell, writer and Hartford Current contributor. You can see more of her stories in our series at WNPR.org/where we live and read her latest column in the Hartford Current. Coming up next, we'll continue our conversation on homelessness with Roseanne Haggerty from Community Solutions. We'll take your calls as well at 860-275-7266. Are we doing enough to end homelessness in our state? 860-275-7266. You can tweet us at Where We Live and at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll revisit our conversation on rail safety after last week's tragic derailment in Philadelphia. How safe are our trains here in Connecticut? Why aren't we investing more in infrastructure? And why do we wait to invest until after another disaster? Hope you can join our conversation. That's happening tomorrow, Where We Live. Today, we're continuing our ongoing series about attempts to end homelessness in our state. To find out more about the 100-day challenge that Susan Campbell's been reporting on for us, go to our Facebook page, Where We Live. This effort in Hartford is just one of many similar initiatives around the country. Next, we're talking with Roseanne Haggerty, president and founder of Community Solutions, about Zero 2016, a national effort to help 75 communities across the country end chronic and veteran homelessness outright by the end of 2016. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Roseanne will be speaking tomorrow, May 19th, from 8 to 10 a.m. at an open house for the Christian Community Action's Arise Center in New Haven about some of these issues. More information on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Roseanne, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Tell us more about Zero 2016. What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, Zero 2016 is a movement of communities across the country aiming to end veteran homelessness by the end of this year and chronic homelessness by the end of next year. And I'm very proud of the fact, being a Connecticut native, that Connecticut is one of four states where the entire state has signed on to this ambitious and achievable goal.
Tell us about these two goals, maybe in pieces here. Veteran homelessness is something we've talked about on the program before. It's something that's obviously an incredibly important issue. What's the scope of veterans homelessness here in Connecticut, but also nationally, that we're trying to tackle by the end of this year?
Nationally, veteran homelessness is below 50,000 for the first time since we started counting. And so this has been going in the right direction, John, for a few years, an over 33% decrease in the last 2 years alone. And in Connecticut, the number we call the takedown target, where we have to get in this state, is housing 858 people by the end of the year, 858 veterans who are homeless across Connecticut. And so that's from now to the end of the year, that's 57 veterans who need to be housed each month.
So that seems like a pretty big problem to solve by the end of the year. So how do you propose to do this?
Well, actually, it's a totally achievable goal. And what we see is that communities, and the 100-day challenge is a good example of this. Communities, when they put their resources together, really work through a coordinated system to prioritize those who are most in need of housing and tie all of the resources of communities together, the housing authorities, the landlords, the not-for-profits, the VA. This is we're seeing outstanding performance around the country, and Connecticut is a leader in showing what can be done when people work together and really coordinate their resources.
And these short burst coordinated efforts, like the 100-day challenge that we've been talking about, they are showing some results. I guess the question is coordinating all of these efforts, because if you've got Greater Hartford doing it and Greater New Haven doing it and every single place in the entire country trying something like this, how difficult is the coordination of these efforts? Because Lord knows you don't want to be spending money unnecessarily. You don't want to be duplicating efforts.
Well, that is the key. The unit that gets coordinated is really something called the continuum of care. And there are six of these entities in Connecticut. That's the entity into which HUD funding flows. And so there are six different regions of the state, each within their region, coordinating their local agenda. And the key that we found, and where communities have made tremendous progress, is using tools taken from other sectors, performance management tools, having very clear, real-time, person-specific data, having clear 30-day objectives, having a direct feedback loop on how are we doing against our goal, having all of these individuals and entities who have to coordinate, the VA, the housing authorities, the continuum of care, the not-for-profits, actually working from the same script. And these are tools that you see and approaches used in the private sector, say in manufacturing or when you're developing a new product. And what's new is helping communities to actually adopt them to solve a complex problems like homelessness. We've seen tremendous progress, and Connecticut, as I mentioned, is a leader. In fact, Connecticut is on track to end chronic homelessness by the end of 2016. There are just over 1,000 chronically homeless individuals living in the state, and at the rate Connecticut is housing those individuals, they are on track to get to that goal. With veterans, we need probably more landlords to participate in making apartments available.
So what are some of your biggest barriers right now as you look to do these things by the end of 2015, 2016? What are the biggest things standing in your way?
The biggest barriers, John, would be landlords coming forward to participate as members of their community and helping to get this goal achieved. The coordination, as you pointed out, is a challenge, but the tools are there. It just requires a new way of working, and that really is the breakthrough notion that communities often have more resources than they realize, but for want of clarity and coordination about the task to be accomplished and what success looks like and who's doing what, that there's too much friction in the process. But Connecticut has been really an exemplary a vanguard state in showing that communities can put these resources together and work very quickly and efficiently. I give a lot of credit to people like Lisa Tepper Bates and people like Matt Morgan, who are just featured on the show, as being leaders in their statewide and their communities in showing groups how to come together and really be smart about working as a team.
We're talking with Roseanne Haggerty, and she's president and founder of Community Solutions, and we're talking about the attempt to end chronic homelessness, not just in Connecticut, but in the country by the end of next year, and also end veterans homelessness by the end of this year. If you have thoughts or questions, 860-275-7266, or if you do work in this world, we'd also love to hear from you. Please give us a call. I just want to get back to that coordination piece. We've often heard that attempts to apply business practices to the nonprofit world is something that people aspire to, but it's not always the easiest thing to do. The groups that have come together, the coalitions that have come together to feed, clothe, house people in need come from a wide variety of different sorts of organizations, not-for-profit, very small organizations, church-based groups. And just frankly, working in a nonprofit myself, sometimes nonprofits aren't always the best at making like the business decision that needs to be made. So how hard is that coordination piece? I know you've talked about it a little bit, but I mean, to a certain extent, are we trying to ask people to do something that they're not naturally equipped to do, work together in this kind of lean management style to get something done in a very quick way?
Well, I'll tell you what's different about this and what I think is the breakthrough practice, which is having a very clear, measurable, and time-bound goal. This isn't a call to open-ended collaboration. This is about getting a specific job done with a specific number of people to be housed whose names we know. And that's the power, having in each of these six regions of the state, knowing exactly who those veterans are by name and what it's going to take to house those individuals and a deadline. And I think most coordination doesn't, and aspiration to coordinate doesn't have those clear parameters. So that's what's different, John.
I'm going to get to some phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. Is the problem for homeless veterans more acute than the problem of homelessness or chronic homelessness as a whole in our country? I mean, do we actually have a much higher percentage of chronically homeless veterans than we should? Mm-hmm.
When the country started off on this goal of ending veteran homelessness by the end of this year, there was a disproportionate number of veterans among the homeless. Fortunately, that number has come down, and it's a real case in point to respond to your question that with focused attention against a deadline, orienting everyone toward a very specific goal, having feedback about how are we actually doing, and putting resources behind that. You'll notice I didn't say the barrier, is really apartments. It's not having the rent subsidies. For veterans, the VA has provided and Congress has funded additional rent subsidies and case management resources for veterans. So landlords should know that all of the support that those individuals would need, both to pay the rent and to manage getting back into their community, that's already been funded. We just need those apartments.
So literally, it is about the housing. It's not about paying for the housing. Mm-hmm. Let's get to John, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I live in an apartment building downtown, and there's an elderly gentleman that lives sort of in the woods in the apartment building. And he's physically not in great shape. And on numerous occasions, I've tried to interact with him and say, hey, can I get you some food, something you need? And he's always been very adamant, almost irritated that I'm asking him, about his well-being. And he just, no, I don't need any help. I don't want anything. He just wants to be left alone. And I want to help because he looks so in rough shape. And, I mean, what do you do in a situation like this?
John, thank you for your question. Roseanne?
First of all, John, I want to thank you for taking responsibility and for assisting that man. I've often found in my work it takes many, many, many such encounters to persuade people that help is available. I hope that you will call the station so that we can get more information on that man's location. I have a feeling that probably some of the great providers in Hartford are also aware of that gentleman, but let's make sure that's the case so that they can follow up on your good work and offer him every help. And your instinct is absolutely right. People who are homeless for a long period of time, it takes, studies show, 25 years off your life. So it really is a very treacherous health condition that he's facing. So thank you for following up on that.
And we're going to get some information from John off the air so that we can get that to you, and hopefully we can make sure to get some information. You know, we just have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you how you feel this project, Zero 2016, is going so far, and how you're going to be able to measure it along the way. If people want to either take part or know how things are going, what's the best way to find out more information about this?
Okay. I'll first of all direct you to two places, our website, www.cmtysolutions.org or zero.org. That will keep you up to date on how the movement is going in communities around the country. We are aiming to be at 50% of the communities on track by the end of June, and that seems very achievable. One of the things that we've seen in many communities is that they're getting to the veteran goal more quickly than the chronic goal. Other communities, interestingly, a smaller cohort are getting to the chronic goal more quickly. So there's a lot of variation. We're beginning a series of training boot camps with communities around the country to accelerate their placement processes. So it's a very dynamic and fast-moving initiative, but we're excited to see so many communities pulling into the space where they're going to hit those critical goals.
If I may ask, with a little less than a month left in the state legislative session, is there something that you need state lawmakers to know about the work that you're doing?
I think the state should just be incredibly proud of the fact that it stepped up to this goal. Like, everyone who's part of it is working in such a leadership way. Connecticut, as I mentioned, is one of four states, and so this is an opportunity for Connecticut really to shine and be the first state in the country to hit this goal of, on a statewide basis, ending veteran homelessness and ending chronic homelessness.
Mm. As we close out the program, you gave us some websites where people can find out more information and take part. Just the advice that you gave John, who called in, is something I guess I want to close with you on. People don't really know how to act around this issue. Mm-hmm. People who have a roof over their heads and who don't feel that they're going to ever be in this situation probably don't see it as much. Do you think that's a big part of the problem, that because in many of our communities we just don't have a whole lot of people visible to us every day, it is a problem that we can kind of sweep under the rug and think, well, somebody must be taking care of that?
I think that's right, that the less visible it is, the harder it is to feel it's the urgent and pervasive problem it is. I also have seen many people, you know, just sort of assume that someone must have the ball here, that it's so plainly something that we don't want to have happening to people in our communities. But as the gentleman who called in indicated, this is a life-threatening condition for people. And there is a solution that works, supportive housing, as you've broadcast in Susan Campbell's series. And our job is to see that everyone gets connected to a home. It's an easier problem to solve than to let remain.
And that really is it. It's getting people a home. And that's what we sort of keep coming back to throughout the series, is that there's a lot of other interventions that are needed. There's a lot of help that's needed as far as documents and paperwork. There's a lot of still work that needs to be done with shelters in the state so that people in an emergency situation can find a place to stay for a time. But you're saying over and over again, you find that once you get somebody in a house, all these other things tend to take care of themselves more.
Yeah, it's proven over many years in many studies, and it's just kind of intuitively logical. You know, you're going to do better at getting a job, managing your health, reviving your relationships with family and friends if you have a stable place. And we can do that for people because we're spending a whole lot to do a lot less.
Mm. Roseanne Haggerty is president and founder of Community Solutions. She'll be speaking tomorrow, May 19th, from 8 to 10 a.m. It's in an open house for the Christian Community Action's Arise Center in New Haven. If you'd like more information, go to our website, wnpr.org/where we live. We'll also have links to some of the other resources that we've been talking about today, whether it has to do with chronic homelessness or has to do with fuel assistance. Roseanne, I want to thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer, Katie Solarski, also produced the series with Susan Campbell. You can continue this conversation on our website. It's wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.